Hi, I'm Terry, Instagram's sassy sober mum. Welcome to my podcast, Sober Stories from Everyday People. Bringing you stories from people just like you and I, the aim of this podcast is to share our experiences with drinking and how we got and stayed successfully sober. Just before we jump into the episode this week, I wanted to share a little bit about the Thrive community that I run. It's a place where many like-minded women go to connect and share their experience with getting and staying successfully sober. There are different sections, like the main Thrive community feed, where people post about things that are up and coming or about challenges they're facing, and they get incredible support from other members of the group. It really is a special, special place to be right now. There are also sections to share your milestones, because every win, even the really small ones, are a big thing to celebrate, and we acknowledge that. There are Thrive events, there are the weekly Zoom recordings, so you can go back and see all the weekly Zoom meetings and all the topics that have been covered in those meetings at your own leisure. There's a share sober tips section, and then there are group chats for the first 30 days, the first 100 days, the first year, and over a year. There's a knowledge hub as well, and in the knowledge hub you'll find a place for books and book recommendations. There's a section of how to survive the first 30 days. So if you come in completely brand new to getting sober, you can hit the ground running and find tools and information to get a structure set up for yourself from the outset. There's also my Thrive Sober program. There's a toolkit. There's understanding the brain science and a space to read and learn about all the topics under emotional sobriety, most of which have been written by myself. So come into Thrive. If you're thinking about it or you're lacking community, I would say just jump in and go for it. And maybe we'll see you in there soon. Hello and welcome to Sober Stories from Everyday People. Today I'm talking to James in Bristol, and he's been sober 1,318 days, which is basically about 3.5 years. Thank you so much for joining me today, James.
Thank you for having me on. Really looking forward to it. Really looking forward to our conversation.
Absolute pleasure. So before we get into the drinking, why don't you tell us a little bit about who you are, and we'll go from there.
Yeah, thank you. So my name is James. I, like you said, I live in Bristol. I have two young children. I have a 9-year-old and a nearly 3-year-old. So they keep me busy all of the time and keep me on my toes. My wife, Kirsty, who I've been married to, we literally just celebrated our 15-year wedding anniversary. And we've been together 22 years this year. So when we get onto it a bit later, she's seen me through my my worst sort of drinking, and she's seen my recovery and has been a big part of my recovery as well. So she's literally the glue that holds the family together. So that's good. I work as a finance assistant, which is extremely boring, so I'm not even going to talk about that any more than that. But yeah, I mean, my passion is football. We were just having a quick chat before about football. And I support Bristol City. I watch far too much football, but that is my passion, and that keeps me sane with the stresses of family life and work and everything. So yeah, that's pretty much me in a nutshell, really.
Oh, the football thing. My husband's football mad, and as we were saying before we came online, I got really into football. It's quite addictive, actually. Once you like really properly get into football, I find myself most weekends, when it's the season, when it's on, I'm like, okay, what games are on? Like, which ones, right, we watch that, or we'll watch Spurs and that tomorrow. And I honestly could watch like 5 games in a weekend. So
it is addictive. And as someone that's got, I've got a very sort of addictive nature as well. So I've got to sort of rein myself in quite often with it, because I go and watch a lot of games as well. And yeah. there's there are some weeks where I could be out every night of the week. I'm not, but it is tempting.
Whenever I go to watch Bournemouth play live, which isn't very often because, of course, it's all pretty much season tickets and trying to get my head around the whole ballot thing and I haven't got enough home points and all that kind of drama. I absolutely love it when I go.
Yeah. It's
nothing like... And we do a few away games. And the atmosphere is great, you know. So, and I imagine as well that the drinking culture with the football was probably been a big thing in your life. So anyway, let's jump into your story. So tell us about your life with alcohol.
So growing up, alcohol was never really a thing for me until I got to like the age of 16. I would say probably 16 is when I first started really noticing alcohol. I mean, growing up, so from the age of, say, I think I was about 10 when I first went to football, roughly. I can't remember exactly, but I was around 10 years old when I first went to football. And it was obviously a thing, but it was just not a thing that I was interested in. I was so interested just in the football. And obviously, I was only 10 years old as well, but I was so interested in the football. And it just wasn't really a thing that was really in my life. And like I said, about the age of 16, I started taking an interest in it a little, or not taking an interest even so much, but sort of started noticing it. And then, like on a Saturday night, my parents would have a drink or two. We used to go to my grandparents' house on a Saturday night, and they would all have a drink, but it never really bothered me or made me interested. And then when I was about 16, I remember saying to my dad, "Oh, can I try a beer?" And I tried a bit, and it was horrible. You know, it was properly like, I just thought, this is the worst thing in the world. Why would anybody want this? This is horrible. But then I sort of had I tried it a couple more times. I wish I hadn't, because it wasn't my parents' fault by no means, you know. But I wish I hadn't tried it anymore. And then I think when I was about just before I turned 17, I went to the pub with my dad to watch football. And we were in there, and he said, "Oh, do you want a drink?" And I said, "Oh, can I have a cider shandy sort of thing?" So I had a cider shandy. And again, didn't really enjoy it. But I was in a pub, do you know what I mean? It's like, it's that environment where you don't want to say you don't enjoy it, so you just drink it anyway.
Yeah.
And then... I had a couple more, not a lot, I just had a couple more shandies over a period of time. And I started to develop a taste for it. And then it went from shandies to pints of cider. And then I can remember I was in a pub and my dad used to drink John Smith's. Mm. And I was like, "Oh, can I try a John Smith's?" Which is not a drink that 17-year-olds drink.
Yeah.
You know, and I tried it and I actually quite liked it. I think it's because it was quite smooth and I quite liked it. So I started drinking that. And then when I was 17 is probably when I first started drinking sort of properly, which is a horrible word to use. But I was drinking John Smith's. And like I said, John Smith's is such it's what is seen as an all man's drink, especially when you're 17. But I started drinking that. And then I started going out. Like when I was 17 going into 18, I started going out quite a lot and socialising. And by socialising, I mean drinking in the pubs. And I would say probably from the age of, and this is very sort of a broad range here, but from the ages of, say, 17 to 24, I was out drinking some weeks, 5-6 nights a week. And it was... Like, I think it's one of those things that at the time when I was drinking, you don't really take account of what you're doing and how much you're drinking. But I was drinking far too much, you know, and I was getting into situations where, like Saturday, for example, I would go out at midday, I would go to the pub, meet my mates, or we'd go for breakfast, go to the pub at 12 o'clock, watch the football. The football was important, it's always been important, but the football at this point was more of a sideshow. It was an excuse to go out drinking, yeah, really.
Mm.
And then I was in the pub from, say, midday till whatever time, and I was doing this week in, week out for a good few years. And I think it's one of those things that, like, now that I can look back, now that I'm sober, I can look back and think, I wish I hadn't done it. But at the same time, I did have a good time as well. Do you know what I mean? Like, there's a massive element of regret for, one, the people that I upset and the silly things that I did. But also, I think, well, I was young and stupid, but I had a good time. And I never broke the law, for example. Do you know what I mean? So, like, I don't have those regrets, whereas I know some people do, but I don't have those regrets. My regrets are more the money that I spent, the people that I upset. I upset people, even though I didn't break any laws, I upset people, and that's a regret that I have. And, like, I think my biggest regret, really, with drinking is that there was many occasions where me and my wife, now girlfriend at the time, or fiance, wherever she was at that stage, where we would have things planned for, like, a Friday, Saturday night. And I especially on a Saturday night, because I would go out, I would get drunk, and I would ruin the evening. And I would just, I didn't necessarily mean to, but I did. There's no getting away from it. I did ruin the evening. And that happened on so many occasions, where what should have been a pleasant evening wasn't, because I ruined it. You know, and I was drunk, and I don't know if we can use this language on here, but I was an absolute knobhead, really. Let's be honest, that's probably the best way to describe it. And I ruined what should have been a nice evening. And I did that on quite a lot of occasions. And even, I mean, we got married at the age of 24, and I got drunk on our wedding day, because it was massive, basically a massive party. We were 24. We were still, again, looking back, we were quite young when we got married. It was a massive party. People were buying me drinks. I wasn't saying no. I didn't know how to say no back then. You know, if someone said to me, "Do you want to come out and for a drink?" It didn't matter if I'd known them 5 minutes or 5 years. You know, I was going out for a drink with them. And my problem was, as well, is that I could never. And I think, because I've done quite a lot of research on this over the last few years, I could never moderate. I could never ever say, "I just have one or two tonight and go home." As soon as that drink touched my lips, that was it. It was sort of game over to a certain extent.
Yeah.
You know, I can remember maybe one or two occasions, which is silly, where I go out and I would just have one or two, but I could never see the point in it.
Mm.
To me, going out was going out. And if I mean, there used to be a running joke on a Saturday. Like I said, I'd go in the pub at like 12. And then quite often on a Saturday, sort of around 6 o'clock, my dad would come into the pub that I drank in and have a couple of drinks, you know, but he would have a couple of drinks and then go in for his tea, sort of thing. But by the time he came into the pub, it was a running joke that I'd had at least 6 pints and even a couple of shots by 6 o'clock, which... And at the time, you know, we all laughed because it was funny,
yeah.
But it wasn't. I suppose it was funny to a certain extent at the time, but it wasn't, because, like I said, especially on the nights when we had stuff planned, it ruined a lot of what should have been memorable and joyous occasions. I ruined because I was drunk, and that's my biggest regret. And I think at the time, I never really thought that I had a problem with alcohol, because I was functioning. Do you know what I mean? I was going to work every day. I've always had an office job, so I was going to work 5 days a week. But even there were times, even in work, where, I mean, I can remember one time I went into work in the morning, and my boss, he was such a nice bloke, and I'm still in touch with him today. And I went into work in the morning, and he was like, "Were you out last night?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "I can tell straight away." He said, "I can tell." And I was like, "I think I was still drunk." When I was having this conversation with him. And I said to him, he said to me, "Why don't you go and get some breakfast?" He said, "You're clearly not fit to be here." He said, "Why don't you go and get some breakfast and come back?" And I was like, "I can't stomach breakfast." And he was like, "Look, just go home. You're no good." And I was fortunate. I was so, so fortunate, because in a lot of places that would have led to disciplinary action. But he said to me, "Look," he said, "just go home." He said, "Just recover and come back tomorrow." And I did, and obviously I didn't do that again. I didn't turn up to work drunk. There was probably a couple of days where I had sort of sick days, which were hangover days. Mm-hmm. But those are regrets that I have. But you live and learn, and yeah. And I like to think I have I have learned a lot from my past. And a saying that I say a lot is that my past will remind me, it will remind me, but it won't define me. And that's the way that I sort of look at everything now. And I'm never going to come on to sort of like the recovery side of things. But I think when it got to the point where I decided that enough was enough, I never really thought of myself as an alcoholic. But the more that I look back now and reflect on it, I was, because everything that I did and everything that we did, like as a couple, me and my wife, everything that we did, I would always say, is there going to be a drink there? Is there going to be a bar there?
Yeah.
And it's only when I look back now that I think, well, most of what we did, like, I mean, it's very much a cultural thing as well, that in this country, everything we do, weddings, birthdays, yeah, even things like christenings, which is silly when you think about it, because that's celebrating, like, the taking away the religious side of it, that's a celebration for a child, more often than not a christening, isn't it?
Yeah.
But we went to a christening, and I got absolutely drunk, like blind drunk, and it's like, makes no sense. Like, now that I got young children myself, I mean, our children haven't been christened, but if they had and someone turned up and they got drunk, I would now think, well, that's just weird. Yeah. But it is very much our culture is
yeah,
everything revolves around drink, doesn't it?
Yeah, you know? It does. Yeah.
And it's silly. Like, when you think about it, it is silly. But then when you're doing it, you don't think it, when you're there and you're getting drunk, you don't think it's silly. You just think, well, this is great. It's basically a party, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah.
And and then it got to the stage where when I got to about 28-ish, I sort of thought, well, it's doing nothing for me. Alcohol was doing nothing for me, but I didn't really know how to stop.
Mm.
And I think I have quite a lot of conversations with people nowadays about this sort of thing. And it's difficult because when it's such a big part of your life, and it has been for such a long time, it's difficult to envisage a life without alcohol.
Yeah.
And it got to about the age of 28, and I'd had enough of going out every weekend and during the week and sort of getting drunk and that. And then we bought our first house, me and my wife. And then when we moved in, I remember the first night we moved in, we had a bottle of champagne, because again, it's what you do, is what's expected of you to do, like, you know. And then I was very much getting to the point where I thought, no, enough's enough. I've had enough. I want to stop, but I didn't know how to stop. And then in 2021, in 2016, so I was 30, my daughter was born. And when she was born, that's when I thought, no, I need to stop now. I need to stop, and I need to put all my energy into looking after her, raising her. And then she was born and everything was good, happy days. And then when she was about, so I wasn't drinking a lot at this stage. I sort of cut right back because I knew I had major responsibilities. I'd never looked after a child in my life. So when she was born, I was like, what do I do? Do you know what I mean? Like, it was just a massive shock. My wife, very maternal, sort of takes it all in her stride. And I'm there thinking, I don't know what to do. I haven't got a clue. And I still don't. I've got two children. I still don't know what I'm doing. But, you sort of make it up as you go along, and you learn.
I think everyone does.
Yeah, you've got to, haven't you? You've got no choice, and you learn on the job, don't you? Do you know what I mean? So when she was born, I sort of cut right back, and I wasn't really drinking. I might have a drink at home if the football was on, and that's not something I really ever did was drink at home. It was always going out and having a drink. And then I remember when she was about, I was telling her about this on the weekend, actually. She doesn't remember it because she was so young, but she was about 18 months, maybe two, and I went out on a Saturday night with a few mates, and it was one of those nights where, because I had a young child, I very rarely went out, and I got drunk, like really drunk. And then my wife was at home with Bella, my daughter, so she was fine, obviously. And I got up in the morning on a Sunday, and I had a stinking hangover. I was led on the sofa, and my wife said, I'm going out. This is like 8:30 on a Sunday morning. So I'm going out. I think she's going for a run. Something very healthy, complete opposite of the state I was in on the sofa. And I was led down the sofa, and my daughter, all she wanted to do was play with me because she was 18 months, 2 years old. She just wanted my attention. And I was led there, and I was thinking, this isn't right. I shouldn't be led here hungover when she just wants my attention. So I'm glad this happened, because I had to get up. I had to get on with the day, and I had to look after her. And I thought to myself, this isn't right. This shouldn't be happening. And that was probably the last time that I got really drunk and had a hangover. And I can remember it so clearly. I mean, she's 9 now, and I was telling her about this on Saturday, because she was saying to me, she actually asked me the question, because she's very aware now that I don't drink, and that she uses the word sober, which is fantastic. And she said to me, do you wish you hadn't drank? Like, just in general, not that particular day. She doesn't remember it. Yeah. But I told her about that day. And I said to her, you and Ollie, this is my son, I said, you're the reason why I'm sober today. I said, because I want to be present for you. And that. And Ollie's never seen me with a drink in my hand. And he, by the grace of God, he won't. And Bella's very aware that I'm sober. I think I've gone off track a little bit. But she was born, and I decided to stop. And then in terms of recovery, like and stopping completely, in 2021, she's gone away. Bella gone away with my parents or her grandparents for a night in Weymouth, because we had a wedding to go to. And I went to the wedding, and on the way to the wedding, this is November 2021, on the way to the wedding, I went out with a couple of mates, and they were drinking in the car on the way up and out. And I wasn't driving, but obviously the driver wasn't drinking. But me and two other mates who were passengers, the two other people were driving. And by this point, I was 30 when I... No, I wasn't. That's wishful thinking, isn't it? I was 36 when I stopped drinking. And I was in the car, and they were like, oh, do you want to drink? And I was like, no, thanks. I'm not going to drink today. And then, of course, peer pressure. You're at a wedding. We got to the venue. I hadn't had a drink in the car on the way out, because I never saw the point in that anyway. But we got to the venue, and they were like, oh, you're going to have a drink? And I was like... And I really, really, really wanted to say, no, I'm not drinking anymore.
Mm.
But I couldn't, because I didn't know myself whether that was going to be true or not.
Yeah.
And I didn't want to say it if it wasn't going to be true. So we got to the venue, and they were having a drink. So I just have a drink. Because everybody, I think the hardest thing for me was that everybody expected me to be the life and soul of the party.
Yeah.
And in order to do that, I felt like I needed to have a drink.
Yeah.
Right. But I never. But on this occasion, that's not the case at all. But you, again, when you're so used to something, it's hard to sort of separate yourself from it.
Mm.
So we got to the wedding anyway. I had a drink, and I thought, just have one. Of course, like I said earlier, one's never just one, is it? So I had 5 pints, and then woke up in the morning with a bit of a hangover. Not massive, but a bit of a hangover. Anyway, then we had to drive from the wedding down to Weymouth. The wife was driving. So, and on the way in the car to Weymouth, I said to myself, I'm never going to drink again. And it was the first time that I've said it, and to myself, meant it. So we drove down to Weymouth, and I'm having an internal discussion with myself, like an internal argument. Well, you are going to drink again. No, I'm not. Yeah, you are. No, I'm not. So anyway, I decided that from that day onwards, I wouldn't drink again, which is, and we all know that's easier said than done, and a very easy thing to say, but a very difficult thing to do. And then that night we were in Weymouth, and we stayed in a B&B that night. And on the night time, we were down there, and we went in the bar because that's what you do.
Mm.
And we were in the bar, and my mum and dad were there because they were looking after Bella. And they were like, oh, do you want a drink? And I said, I'll just have a Coke. And it was hard, because normally I'd be like, yeah, I'll have a pint of lager or anything. But I just had a Coke. And I woke up the next day, and I was like, right, that's day one done. Do you know what I mean? Like, and I'm glad, really, that we went to the bar that night, because it sort of tested my willpower straight away. And then, I think from then onwards, in a way, it's difficult, because, like, so when I stopped, I was like, right, how do I do this? And of course, it's all down to the individual how to do it. You need to have the willpower. And like, I was fortunate because I was never like my rock bottom wasn't massive at all, really. You know, it was just a gradual decision that I made that I needed to stop drinking, because I used to drink far too much. And then, so when I stopped, so I was like, right, how do I do this? And I can remember I was working in the centre of Bristol one morning, and I'd never really been into podcasts, to be honest, at this stage. And I'd heard about them, but I'd never really listened to any. And I went on to Spotify, and this is, I'm not just saying this because I'm on your podcast. I went on to Spotify and I just typed in sober podcast, and yours came up, and I listened to it. And it was the first time that I sort of like thought, right, I can do this. Do you know what I mean? And I was probably about 6 weeks into sobriety at this point. So I'd gone past that sort of 30-day initial bit. And I wasn't really missing it, because I knew that it wasn't serving me any purpose whatsoever. And I listened to your podcast, and I was like, I can't remember what episode I listened to. Obviously, I just picked a random one. It's probably the one that was out at that time. And I thought, wow, like, it was so, the story that was being told was so relatable. Mm. And it made me realise that I'm not the only person that's going through this or you know, or in the middle of it. And, so I listened to your podcast. So thank you, first of all, because your podcast really, it is inspiring. Do you know what I mean? It is, because it is so relatable. And hopefully people that are listening to this episode can relate to my story as well and take something from it, because you don't have to hit that rock bottom to quit drinking.
To do it, yeah.
And I think that's a really, really important message, because the film version of an alcoholic and the reality of an alcoholic are very, very different. Mm. And I think that's one thing that I've learned so much, because I'll be honest, I do my own podcast now. You sort of inspired me massively because it's very difficult to have these conversations for a lot of people, you know, and it's the word alcoholic. You have, people have visions of people like in the gutter, you know, with a bottle of wine, because that's what the TVs and the films teach you. But that's not the case whatsoever. So in my recovery, like I said, I've been sober just over 3.5 years now. And about 3 months ago, I attended an AA meeting. And the reason that I did, because for years, I just thought, well, AA meetings are full of people who have got no hope in life. Because that is honestly what I thought, because that is the image that a lot of people portray of it. So about 3 months ago, I went to an AA meeting, because I've had conversations with people who said that AA meetings saved their life. And I was like, do you know what? I need to find out for myself if it's what it's like. Because like with most things in life, it's easy to take other people's opinions for things, but you've got to find out for yourself. Mm-hmm. And I thought, do you know what? I've got nothing to lose from going to an AA meeting. So I went to one. Well, I actually joined one online, actually, first of all, because of work commitments and family life and everything. And I was like, wow, this is actually quite interesting. And again, it made me realise that the people who are on these meetings aren't particularly, they're not down and out. They're being, and I don't know, have you ever been to an AA meeting?
No, I haven't. But I know that they do them online, which I think is something that might have come about during COVID, which I think is a really good thing.
Because it was.
Isn't there something like 24 hours a day you can?
Yeah, literally. And I know this isn't an AA podcast, and don't get me wrong as well, I fully appreciate that AA is not for everybody, because there is a element of religion involved in it as well. Mm. But I just thought I'd go along and see. And I don't do them all the time, do you know what I mean? I'm not sort of obsessed by them, but it's a tool that can be useful for people. And I've got stuff, because on the AA meetings, people share their strength, hope and experiences on there. Mm-hmm. And that, to me, connection is important. Yeah. You know, and I think the more that people talk about alcoholism and addictions in general, the more that people talk about it, the better, because it's easy to not talk about it, but it's extremely difficult to talk about it. And when people ask me now about like my recovery and that, I always say to people, and I'm sure you do as well, I don't want to put words into your mouth, but I'm sure you do, that everybody's recovery and journey, they're completely different, aren't they?
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like I said, I've listened to your podcast, and I've listened to your journey as well. And it's difficult, for me anyway, it's difficult to give advice in the sense that what worked for me won't necessarily work for somebody else. I mean, I just decided one day, not going to drink again, and that was it. But I know it's not that easy for everybody else.
Yeah.
Or for certain people, you know, and to go cold turkey is challenging for a lot of people. Mm-hmm. But that's my journey with alcohol. So it started off not wanting to drink, then I drank a lot, and then I went back to not wanting to drink. And then I made that decision, like I said, just over 3.5 years ago, to not drink again. And touch wood, I will never pick up a drink again.
Yeah, amazing. I think it's so interesting the way that, you know, when you were talking about the culture around alcohol, and I do think that we are in a pocket of time, people like you and I, maybe people slightly younger, people slightly older, where alcohol is this just so heavily glamorized thing. And obviously alcohol has a huge history as well, you know, dating back to what? I mean, probably actually thousands of years, but certainly in the last like 400, 500, 600 years, you know, people used to drink alcohol more than they would drink the water. And, you know, so we have got this like very ingrained culture. And it is the thing that a lot of people rely on for all the things. You're absolutely right. Like when you scan across your childhood growing up and into adulthood and even your life now, like I'm sure you can find plenty of people that are on that like celebratory alcohol bus, always having alcohol at the weddings, the play dates. That's a big one in the mundane world, you know. And I was doing that myself. I was that person. And it, like you said, any excuse to have a drink and, you know, inverted commas, let your hair down. And it's, I wonder, the more and more I'm in my own sobriety and running this podcast and working with people and just being in this community, I wonder how many people actually could have yours and my story and be almost oblivious to the fact that it is actually quite heavy drinking, but because everybody else around them is doing it, or families are doing it, or culturally that's the expectation.
It's accepted, isn't it?
It's like, people, are there people out there that can drink at the level that we were drinking that aren't thinking about the fact that they're drinking too much, that they're just completely oblivious? I guess there are. But I think what I'm trying to say is, I think that, yeah, I mean, at least half of the global population drink, right? It's like at least 50% drink.
Yeah.
And that's a lot of people. And there must be in that huge global figure of people, there must be many, many, many alcoholics or grey area drinkers or over drinkers or whatever the terms are that we use to describe that drinking. People are drinking in the week or even every day or most weekends or what, you know, and it's like a constant thread in people's lives. And all of it is probably too much.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's just, I just find it quite interesting. I think a lot of it, you know, when you talked about almost like sort of semi-spontaneous sobriety, well, and that actually you made your decision and that was it, you knew. I was thinking, interestingly, what you gave up at what, 36?
36, yeah.
Got the maths right there.
Yeah.
But it sounded like you were being quite sober curious from kind of 28.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's 8 years of, actually, if you were to relive those 8 years, and collect the days or the hours that you felt crap about drinking or hungover or had feelings of, I wish I could stop or I shouldn't be doing this, you know, having those inner nudges. That 8 years is actually a really long time. That's like a quite a, that's quite a climb up to that point. So it's almost like, you know, it's, yeah, it can take you. I was the same. I did my first sober stint at 30. I didn't stop drinking until I was 41. That's 11 years, right?
Yeah.
I knew back when I was 30 that I was over drinking and it was causing chaos. But it took all that time to get to the point where I was like, right, that's it. And actually, like you, when I got to that point, everything in my body lined up that this was the right thing to do. And yeah. So, you know, I know people, like you were saying, can sometimes feel like they might be flip-flopping. And it takes them a while to get to that place where they're all in alignment. But for me, I'd spent 11 years trying to get into alignment is the way I look at it. And yeah. Then I, once I'd really made that decision, I was like fully, fully in like you were. And I do think that when you get into that energy, it is easier because it's definitely. Kind of, you have to do it then, you know, you just, I don't know, it's just something in you that really has to do it.
I think the hard thing is as well for like, it's, and you're right, really, what you just said. Like there was sort of a long period of time where I knew I needed to stop drinking because, like I said, it was serving me no purpose or doing me any good whatsoever. But I think a couple of times that I sort of went, probably, I can't remember exactly, but I probably went like a few weeks or maybe even a couple of months without having a drink. But I think for me as well, because I always used to go out and drink it. Like I said, it's not very often I drank at home, but I used to go out and drink. It's telling other people that you're not drinking anymore and dealing with the reaction of other people, which I think is something that a lot of people struggle with. When really, I know this now, and I, like I said, since I made the decision to go sober, it doesn't bother me at all. But it's other people's reactions to your sobriety can make a big difference on how your journey goes.
It's so true.
Because when, like I said, like a lot of my social life revolves around football, and football is heavily ingrained. There's a big drinking culture out of football. And I was like, when I first made the decision to go sober, I was like, can I still do the things that I love sober? And or not necessarily, well, yes, can I do the things that I love sober? But also, what would the reaction of other people around me be? But it doesn't make any difference. But it's easy for me to sit here now and say it doesn't make any difference. But for somebody who's just starting their journey, it can make a hell of a difference.
It's a big deal. You know,
it is. And I mean, the amount of conversations I've had with people at football and I obviously football is a game for everybody. I'm not saying for one second that it isn't, because it is. But a lot of conversations I have with people at football are with men who have been doing this for 25, 30, maybe 40 years, regardless of how long it is. And they cannot see that they can go to football and not have a drink because it is such a big part of it. My answer to that is you can, you just need to have that strength of character to say to the people that are so used to seeing you with a drink that you don't need to have a drink to have a good time. I totally get it. It's so hard to do. And I can remember when I first made the decision myself to stop completely and go sober, the number of people that said to me, "Well, do you think you'll have a drink again? Or you're going to have a drink soon, aren't you?" And it's saying no, simply no, I'm not. Because no is the hardest word to say, but that has the most impact.
Yeah.
And I mean, because I can remember saying to people, "I'm not going to drink again." They were like, "Yeah, you will." I was like, "I won't. I don't want to." Do you know what I mean? Like, leave me alone, basically. Do you know what I mean? But and I think sometimes the people that have these conversations with you are the people that are questioning their own drinking, but can't bring themselves to deal with it. Yeah. So, and like I said, when I used to go out, I used to be the life and soul of the party. But I can still go to a party now and have a great time and make people laugh, and, you know, and I'm not a big fan of dancing, but if the wife wants to have a dance, I'd get up and have a dance. I'm not a big fan of it. But you can still go and you can still do everything you did sober. And the beauty of it is, for me anyway, and I can only, as you can only talk about yourself, but the beauty for me is that you can wait. I can wake up in the morning. I can go out. I can go out football, or I can go out for a meal with the wife, or whatever it might be. And I can get up in the morning, and I can be fresh. And you don't have that horrible, horrible hangover. And nobody that takes up sobriety misses hangovers.
Oh God! Honestly, I still at even just over 6 years, it still really makes me feel so good that I never have a hangover again, and that I don't know what a hangover feels like. No. I mean, obviously I remember, but you know, it's not part of my life anymore, and I just feel so always so grateful for that. I really, really do.
And on Saturday morning, just gone, on Saturday morning, I woke up and I had a headache, and it was a genuine headache.
Yeah.
And I was led there, and I was thinking, this is just a headache. Do you know what I mean? Like, it will pass. But it did make me think back to when I used to have a hangover. You know what I mean? But that was self-inflicted. This was just a headache that I had.
Yes.
And I took out paracetamol, you know, and drank some water and it had gone within a couple of hours. But I thought, oh, imagine that. But all day with the fear of, I mean, and the worst thing as well is I remember quite a few occasions, or a lot of occasions actually, in reality, a lot of occasions where I woke up and I didn't know what I'd done the night before. I didn't know who I upset. I didn't know where my wallet was, phone. I mean, I was quite lucky really that I never very often lost things, but you don't get any of that in sobriety. You know, you wake up, you know where everything is.
Yeah.
You know that you haven't annoyed anybody or upset anybody. And there's not really, well, there isn't any, there's no downside to sobriety, is there?
No. And that's really interesting, isn't it? Like, you know, that feeling, just knowing in your heart and soul every morning when you wake up that you're living a better life, like with your health and with your mindset, with, you know, with your mental health. And just physically as well. And like not having those things like the shame and regret and spent too much money and the fear of, well, am I going to just do it all again tonight or tomorrow or that wedding next week? Am I going to make an idiot of myself at that wedding? And having all of that anxiety, like the price for that freedom of wiping all of that clean is just stopping drinking. You know, just stopping something that you will have just fallen into anyway as a teenager because everybody was doing it. And then suddenly when life got quite hard, as it can, when you're growing up and you know, those people around you, everyone's drinking, you just get into just a bad pattern of it. And then before you know it, you're just doing it for all the things, like you were saying, the expectations and the pressure to continue being the person that you were when you were 20, even though you're in your mid-30s or whatever, is so silly, really. In fact, I actually find it really sad. You know, when you were talking, I was thinking, isn't it just so sad that the expectation is that we just all freeze in time and that we don't grow and develop, don't decide that we can live a healthier way? And that's the thing, isn't it? I always think to myself, now we change every single day. Everything changes every day. The trees don't stay the same. You know, the animals around us don't stay the same. We don't stay the same. Like, we get a little bit older every day. And I just find it bizarre that actually change is part of life and it's okay to change. But yet when it comes to this relationship with alcohol and the ties that we have socially with the people around us and the expectations, we're not allowed to change. And that's where there's a big disconnect. And you're absolutely right. I think that creates a lot of aggro for people when they're trying to stop.
I think it's really interesting what you just, really, really interesting what you just said as well, because to me, like, when you get, as you get older, and I like to think I'm not old, but I am getting older by the day, because we all are, unfortunately, aren't we? But I was chatting about this last week because I was doing something last week, and a lot of people say to me, "Oh, like, oh, you're doing this, that, or the other now." And I think, well, but why not? Why not try new things as you get older? Because they said earlier, you won't know if you like something until you try it in everything you do. And the sort of analogy, I think that's the right word that I use a lot, is like, I got two young children, like you said, and when children are young, you encourage them to try different things all the time. Like I said earlier, like, if my daughter doesn't like something, I just say to her, I didn't say give up, but I say, look, if it's not for you, it's not for you. Just try something different. And you encourage kids all the time to try something different. Mm. But when you're older, people think you're weird if you try different things all the time. And I just think, like, well, what difference does it make? It's only an age, isn't it? You know? And since I've gone sober, the amount of things that I've tried, whether it be groups, you know, like AA or like, so the last couple of weeks, I sort of got interested in Buddhism, right? Which it's not something that I've ever thought about in my life, right? But mm-hmm. through recovery and that, you find these things, you know? So I sort of taken a bit of an interest in it, right? And I said to my wife last week, I said, I might go to a Buddhism group, but this is very much my all or nothing nature coming out here. Yeah. This is massively, right? So I said, I might go to a Buddhism group. She said, what have you been out for? She said, you've never been interested in Buddhism in your life. Yeah. Well, she's right. I mean, she is right. I've never been interested in it. But yeah. now that I take an why interest, not? I think, why not? Why not? Exactly. Yeah, why not? And I said to her, I said, look, I'm not saying for 1 second I'm going to be a Buddhist, right?
You never know, you might be. You know, well, I might be, put these limitations on yourself.
But the reality is, I'm probably not, right? But I said to her, there's no harm in me going to a Buddhism group, finding out a little bit.
Yeah.
And then you know, if it isn't for me, it isn't for me. But what's the harm in trying it? Because if my daughter said to my wife, oh, I want to be a pilot, right?
Yeah.
So I want to do flying lessons. She would encourage it, but we as a society,
yes,
we don't encourage things for older people, you know. No. And it's I don't get it. Why not? Yeah. Why not?
I've got thoughts on this. So the one thing I'm going to say first is that I remember growing up, and even in my 20s, I always liked, you know, like what you're saying, always love to do new things. Oh, I love a fad, right? I love a fad. And I put my heart and soul into all my little fads. And do you know what? Some things stick and some things are literally a fad. They last, I don't know, 4 weeks, 6 weeks, I don't know. But I always felt embarrassed to have these lots of different interests, because friends would poke the fun out of me, or partners, because they'd be like, oh, here she goes again. Now she's doing this. Now she's training in that. And it is something. I don't know whether that is just a British thing, whether they're doing this in America as well or in Australia. But certainly my experience in this country is that you know, almost made to feel a bit ashamed or shameful for having lots and lots of different interests. Well, now I realise I'm also neurodivergent, and it's a big part of my dopamine, special interests, hyperfocus. And I've learned to love that about myself, because I think there's no way that I would be where I am now doing all the brilliant things I'm doing if I didn't have this kind of huge thirst for all this knowledge and all these different things. But the other thing that I was going to say is that linked to that, when these people, which I have learned now, but when people are criticizing you for changing or changing your mind or doing lots of different things, I just have to remember that people, so many people, walk around projecting their wounds onto you or their insecurities onto you. And it's like what you were saying earlier, you know, one of the biggest reasons I think why people don't like big drinkers to stop drinking is they're not on the same bus anymore. They're not validating their experience. You've gone over there onto Sober Island, and it's really like quite nice. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
That holds too much of a mirror up to other people. Mm. People don't want to look at the things that aren't really working. They don't always want to, don't want to pay attention to that stuff. And I think that, you know, that culture, whatever it is that makes us feel like we should just stay in the one box. By the way, the box is not the right box, but that's another subject. But, you know, the one is to stay in that box forever and never change and never grow and never move. All that does when people stay in those boxes is make everyone else who's stuck in their own box feel more comfortable. And that's why I think there is this bit of conflict in these situations. It's purely, I think the biggest skill that you can learn, actually, I think, in life, is to constantly make sure that when you're perceiving other people's reactions, that they're only projecting their own insecurities onto you, and it actually has nothing to do with you. Like, you're not doing anything wrong. But of course, you have to have a hard exterior to be like, you know, to be able to turn around and say, well, I don't care what you think, really. I'm just going to go off and do this Buddhism thing and
psych
it, you know, why not?
Yeah, why not?
So yeah, it's a funny one. And I do think that that culture can really drag people down in the early days. And I know when I work with, I've obviously got a women's group and I coach a lot of women. One of the biggest things that we have to navigate is how to show up for yourself in those early social situations and be able to advocate for yourself, even if you feel like you're getting like the bullets of shame, like, well, why would you do that? Well, how are you going to have fun again? You know, and yeah, that sort of stuff. So, you know, it is actually one of the big reasons why I think people just turn back and just go, okay, well, I'll drink on the hen do then, or I'll drink on this or I'll drink on that, because I can't cope with the pressure and the expectations to show up as who they were. You know, it's really sad, to be honest. Yeah, but
it's difficult as well.
In your 3 years then, so you've done, you know, obviously for you, we've talked about a lot already and a lot of the kind of the highs and lows. Was there anything really, so you got into the podcast, which is, I'm very happy to hear that you found the podcast. That's exactly what this is for, is to help people like you and I. So that's amazing. Was there anything else that really stood out for you in the earlier part of your journey? I don't know, was there any books or was there anything, did you get into anything else?
So, not in the early parts, to be honest. No, like when I made a decision to start my sobriety journey, I think I thought it was very much just down to me to do it. And there was no, I didn't, maybe I was a little bit sort of self-focused and just thought, right, I need to do this. Nobody can help me do this. It's my journey. I'm on my own, sort of thing.
Yeah.
And that's probably the case for a little while. Then, like I said, I started listening to the podcast, your podcast, which made me realise that it wasn't just me that was on this boat to this island. So I started listening to the podcast. Then I sort of looked at a couple of other podcasts as well. And then I think the longer I've gone on in sobriety, the more I realise, and you used the word earlier, that there's no shame attached to sobriety. And probably over the last, so I've been sober just over 3.5 years, probably in the last 18 months, I've started having a lot more conversations about sobriety. And not that I was never ashamed of it, but I think now that I'm thinking about it, I spent the first 2 years probably thinking that I had to do it all myself, and that I could just carry on and carry on and carry on without talking about it or learning about it. But I've realised now that, like, so over the last 12 months, I've read quite a few books. If I can mention the books on here, then I will. So, yeah. Sober Dave.
Yeah.
I read Super Dave's book recently. I read a book called I'm Never Drinking Again, which is a great title by somebody, I can't remember his name, but that was quite a good book. I've read a couple of books on addiction for footballers, because obviously there's a big interest in that for me. But everything that I read and everything that I listen to, there's always something you can take from it. And I think every conversation that I have with people is a good opportunity for me to learn as much as anything else, and also to share my experiences. So and like I said, I've been to a few AA groups as well, but I think communication and connection are the two sort of biggest tools that you can get in recovery. And I mean, it's still, I mean, every morning that I wake up, I think, great, I'm sober today, you know, and I'm grateful for it. But every day is an opportunity to learn something. I think that's the important thing. And again, it goes back to what you said earlier. Who knows what you're going to learn today? You know, it could be something that you pick up for 4 weeks and like I said, hyper-focus on. And there's nothing wrong with that, you know, and knowledge is power as well, isn't it? You know?
Yeah, also I was going to say, sorry, also just on that, I think if something brings you joy, that's great as well, isn't it? So it's like linking back to that thing.
Of course it is.
If it's a hyper-focus for 2 or 3 weeks, like I just bought myself a new barbecue grill right? I really got like a really nice one, and I'm quite obsessed with it. And it, I cannot tell you how much joy it's bringing me. I've only had it since Friday, but my whole fridge is just full of things that I can put on this grill. I'm just like, I'm sending photos to my husband. I don't know. It lights me up, makes me excited. And but maybe in a month's time, I just might forget about it. I don't know. It might be under a cover for 6 months, but it's okay because it brings you some joy. And I think that's the thing, isn't it? Even if you are doing faddy things. Things, it's just like even going to your Buddhism thing is pushing yourself out of your comfort zone. It's opening your mind. It's expanding your possibilities. You might meet your best friend there.
You don't know, do you?
So I just think that
I must say I haven't been to a Buddhism group yet, but I'm thoroughly intending to go to one. The only problem that I've got now is that the football season is starting up again and the friend is starting again. And that's going to take up most of my time. So, which I'm not complaining for 1 second because I've missed it terribly. And that's brilliant. Going to football, you mentioned mental health earlier as well. And the benefits of sobriety for mental health are insane as well. You know, there's only positive benefits for your mental health when you take up sobriety. And football for me is a big one for my mental health as well. So,
yeah.
But yeah, always try and pick up new things and learn, and like what's the worst that could happen? You learn something, and that's not a bad thing, is it?
No, well, exactly. Or it could bring you some joy.
Well, yeah, and that's not a bad thing either, is it? That's enough of a reason,
isn't it? Absolutely. I think we've
and also, especially if you're in your early days of sobriety, and I'm like massively into my journey. I mean, 3.5 years is 3.5 years, but there's people that have been sober for 30 years. But if you're in your early days of sobriety and you're learning something and it's making you not pick up a drink, then happy days, really, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. Absolutely. I think we've done a good job together really drilling that point home.
Yeah.
Which is a good thing, because I think a lot of people need to hear that it's okay to change. It's okay to have lots of different interests and try new things. And also it's okay to feel sadness that there's a lot of pressure and expectations in the world for you to not get sober. And that, you know, yeah, I think they're very important messages that will reassure people. For you though, what's been like the biggest gain, do you think, getting sober?
I think the biggest gain for me, I mean, first and foremost, is knowing that I'm going to wake up in the morning and be there for my children. That's the biggest thing for me. You know, I think it's hard to put into words, really, but knowing that I can be there for my children 24/7 and anything they need. I mean, touch wood, nothing ever happens to them. But if they're ill or whatever, you know, I can take them to the doctors, or heaven forbid, I take them to a hospital or whatever, you know. But they know their dad's there, and they know their dad's present for them and fully focused for them. My mind's not distracted by needing to have a drink or wanting a drink. And for my wife as well, you know, like if I need to do anything for her, like the other week she broke her foot playing football, which wasn't ideal, you know, but it is what it is. And when you play any sport, there's a risk of injury. But she came in from football. She didn't drive. She came in from football. She was like, I've hurt my foot. And I looked at her foot and I was like, it was bruised. It was swelled, like swelled right up. I was like, you need to go and get it checked out. She's like, no, it'll be all right. Because that's what she's like. Everything will be all right. I was like, no, you need to go. So this is Sunday night. Now, years ago on a Sunday night, I'd have been in the pub all day. Do you know what I mean? I'd been out watching the football in the pub, whatever, been drunk. But I said to her, no, I said, you need to go and get it checked out. So we got in the car Sunday night about 8 o'clock, and I just drove to A&E. And it's just things like that, like just having a clear head, constantly having a clear head and being able to try new things, experience new things. That's the greatest gift that sobriety has given me. And I love the fact that my daughter knows that I don't drink. Do you know what I mean? Like, and she asked me questions about it.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's hard to put into words, really, but I think just the peace of mind that sobriety gives me is the greatest thing for me, really.
Yeah, that's so lovely. It's not that in a trust, isn't it? You can trust yourself, and that means that the people around you can you're reliable and trustworthy, you know.
You're there
for people, but you're also there for yourself as well. I think that self-trust thing is really, really lovely. It's quite special when you've had a lifetime of not having that feeling of waking up panicking, what did I do, who have I hurt, where are my keys? Waking up and feeling that self-trust is just priceless.
And also, not like when the weekend comes now, like I honestly don't think about having a drink, you know. And it's just knowing that on a weekend I can take my little boy to football on a Saturday morning, and then I can go to football in the afternoon and enjoy the occasion for what it is.
Yeah.
Not because I'm going for a drink. Do you know what I mean? So it's just, there's no downside to sobriety. Everything's only positive in sobriety. And anybody that's starting their sober journey, if anybody's listening to this, then just stick with it, because I know it's easier said than done, but just stick with it, because the benefits day by day just grow, in my opinion.
Yeah, so true. Brilliant. Great advice. Sometimes it is a little bit head down. Stick with it.
I think the thing is, it's not easy as well, because we sort of touched on it earlier, but everywhere you go, the sort of alcohol is sort of like pushed on you a little bit.
Yeah.
Even like silly things, like if you go into a supermarket, you can't avoid it. You cannot avoid it. You can't, regardless of how much you try to avoid alcohol, unless you never go out, Or watch the telly, or listen to the radio, or listen to anything, and unless you just shut your eyes forever, you can't avoid it.
Yeah.
And that's a hard thing, because, I mean, my wife still has a drink. Like, she doesn't drink a lot, but she'll have a drink, like a glass of wine on a Friday night, or whatever. And she'll say to me, like, if you're going to a shop, pick up a bottle of wine. Well, I go down the wine aisle and I see drinks that I used to drink.
Yeah.
But it's having the willpower. I think that's a big part of it, because you cannot avoid it. If you're going sober, you cannot avoid alcohol.
Yeah.
But you cannot pick up a drink. And that's a decision that I make on a daily basis, is not pick up a drink.
Mm.
So don't live a life of a recluse, because that is tempting sometimes. But just willpower, connection, and but willpower and connection are the two biggest things for me.
Yeah. Yeah.
And your podcast.
And my podcast, of course. Yeah. And I think, you know, on that, I think it's really interesting, because I think there's a lot as well in relearning how to find joy in a life without alcohol. So kind of really undoing that desire for alcohol. So for me now, I feel like I don't need to rely on willpower personally, because I know that alcohol doesn't give me anything. Do you know what I mean? Like, I've got to that point now where I don't believe having a drink in any situation would enhance my life. It wouldn't make anything better for me.
Yeah, true.
Now that I know, like, to be honest, sometimes it's not like, you know, pudding. Like, I've eaten a big meal from my grill. I really like a pudding, and I get a joy out of pudding. I'm not having pudding at the moment. I'm being good. I'm pre-holiday. I'm being quite good. But, you know, I miss pudding. But with alcohol, it's different, because I don't know. Like, I think I've reconditioned my brain. And I've got to the point now where I just don't feel like there's ever going to be a time where having a drink is going to be better than not having a drink in a situation. Do you know what I mean? So it kind of doesn't.
Yeah, no, totally, register. Yeah.
I think it doesn't. I think you get, as you go further and further into the journey, I think it just becomes more and more, it fades away, that alcohol
for me.
It becomes more out of focus. But yeah, it's, and I think connection is crucial. I think finding stories and people to connect with that get your world and help to validate you, and that you're not broken, or you're not a bad person because you drank, and all these sort of, like you said, it is very pushed on us in society. It's, in a way, it's almost like no wonder if you're susceptible to you know, that sort of thing, whether you like the dopamine or you just, you have a difficult life, or like early, like for me, I had quite a lot of challenges when I was younger. And I think if you have social anxiety, that there's all kinds of different reasons why people drink or start drinking.
Yeah.
And, you know, some people are a little bit more susceptible than others, obviously, whether they drink too much or overdrink. But unfortunately, in a world that just glamorizes alcohol and says, it's okay, you know, then so many of us are going to get caught up in that and trapped in that. And that's, I think that's really important, is to constantly try and work to take that shame away for people.
The thing is, now in society as well, the drinks companies, because they're not stupid, are advertising the 0% stuff as well. Like the alcohol free stuff. And to me, I get it. Like, don't get me wrong, I get why people drink it. But for me, do you drink it? I don't know.
I don't, but I did in the early days, if I'm being honest. I did have my kind of ritual, 2 Beck's Blue in the evening whilst listening to my podcast, whilst cooking my children tea. And, you know, for me, it was more of a ritual thing that I needed for a few months in the beginning. But now I never have any alcohol-free alternatives ever. In fact, I was laughing because before I came on this podcast, I looked in my little fridge. I've got like a little mini drinks sort of fridge with sparkling water and things like that in. And there is a couple of like Lucky Saint beers and things like that. And I just thought, I wonder how long they'll sit there. Cause I don't drink them. You know, I prefer other flavors other than the flavors of wine and beer, you know, I'm quite happy to have a blackcurrant soda or whatever, you know? So yeah. Do you have them?
No, I've not. This is a conversation I've had a lot as well. I've never touched them. That's a very conscious decision that I made right from the start, not to touch them. And the reason is, I mean, I can't say what they taste like, obviously, because I've never had them. But my issue is if I had, say, a Fatcher Zero, then it would probably taste quite similar to the proper stuff.
Yeah.
And if my thought process, because of the way that I am, is that if I had a Zero, I think that's nice. I might just have the proper thing now. And then go and have one. And I don't need that temptation, because I'm quite happy with a can of Coke or orange juice or glass. I do love a glass of milk. I love a cold glass of milk. I don't need the temptation that 0% stuff could bring me.
Yeah,
and that's I do think it would lead me to temptation.
Yeah, I think that's why, you know, linking back to what you're saying earlier, there is no one size fits all. And I definitely think that people have an intuition about things that will or won't work for them. Yeah. And you have to trust that. Like, what's triggering to one person is not to another, but then something else, you know, vice versa. So I think it's important to listen to what you're gut feeling is on things, and if that's
how you think
about it, then that's valid, and it probably would be too much of a temptation. So I mean, I can have those drinks, I just don't particularly like them, if I'm being honest. I wouldn't say I overly love the taste of beer, and I don't like the taste of wine. I it's crazy, as a drinker they were my favourite thing. Like, any drink was great, really, but wine was a big thing because I think it was so strong. I just loved to hear, you can literally have half a glass of wine in one sip and it's like, poof, you get, it used to kind of hit my insides quite quickly and I'd feel the buzz. But that's what I wanted, not really the taste of the wine. But yeah, I mean, don't get me wrong, actually, I do quite like a red wine in a sauce every now and then, if it was like a beef bourguignon, but I don't have that very often. But and also that's cooked and there's no alcohol in it and all that stuff. But I think in the beginning I was very careful. I was very careful about lots and lots of things. I wouldn't actually cook with alcohol and stuff like that. Like, I really wanted to just, like you, I suppose, just avoid temptation, although I did have my Beck's Blue. But after about 3 or 4 months, I just suddenly thought, you know what, I don't really need these anymore. I don't even really love them. I'd much rather have elderflower and whatever, you know, and have other nicer tasting things. So, yeah, they're not really part of my, even on holidays, I would have just lemonade or something.
Yeah.
I wouldn't. Occasionally, if I'm out in a really nice restaurant in London or something like that and everyone's drinking, I might have a mojito, which is a good fake drink to have because it's just lots of lime and soda water in. But they're usually very overpriced for what they are. They're still 10 or 12 quid.
And it's ridiculous, isn't it?
It's all ice and not that much fluid, and it is a bit of a rip-off, and I order it, but then I always feel a bit annoyed, but I don't order them very often. So what would be your top three tips for staying successfully sober?
I think number one, I mean, I don't know if it's a tip or advice, but you've got to want to do it. You know, if you're not in the right mindset, then you're going to struggle. So tip number one would be make sure that you're in the right headspace to give it up, because especially from a social point of view, it's not the easiest thing in the world to do, that's for sure. Number two, stay connected with people. Whether it be just picking up the phone every day or texting somebody and just sort of making yourself accountable, I suppose, to a certain extent. And if you're what am I trying to say here? I'm trying to say stay connected. Like go to groups. It hasn't got to be AA. There's other groups out there. Just make connections with people that are on the same path as you, because like we said earlier, it's easy to carry on drinking. It's very difficult to give it up. And sometimes the people that you've been sort of socializing with or hanging out with that are still drinking, they might not be the most supportive people to be around. So making connections with people that are on the sober journey will make it a lot easier for you. And also, my third tip, and this is probably a really silly one, but I find it really helpful for me, is get an app that tracks your sobriety. For me, I look at it every now and again I'll look at it, and it just reminds me of how far I've come.
Yeah,
and they're free as well, which obviously anything free things are usually quite good, aren't they? So yeah, download an app on your phone. And start tracking your days. That would be a good tip for me, I think.
Yeah.
And not the most powerful insight is tips ever, are they? But
yeah, no,
they help me.
But they're yours, and you know, you have to share what worked for you. And so, I think they're good. Have true desire. Make sure that you make sober connections, and have a guide, you know, in terms of the app where you count the days. I use the app I Am Sober. It's free. And I still have it now. And I check it every now and then, and I surprise myself, like, oh, I'm so many days. Wow. And it tells me how
it's nice, though, isn't it?
Yeah, it's lovely. It feels
and like when you see the milestones as well, it does give you a great sense of achievement, doesn't it?
It does, yeah, it does. And it feels absolutely, yeah, it feels like a big achievement. Really good. And where can we find you and follow you? And you said you've got a podcast and all of those stuff. Tell us how we can connect with you, James.
So I'm on Instagram. I don't really use Instagram a lot, but I'm on there. Well, I'm grateful I am, because that's where I connected with you on there. My handle is @soberfootball. I'm on Facebook, James Skinner. And I'm on Twitter @soberfootball.
Great. And the podcast, is that actually a sober podcast or is it a football podcast?
Yeah, me and a mate of mine started one about 18 months ago we started it, and it's called Sober Sports Talk. So we talk about sobriety, mental health, and we talk about football. And I've just started a new one recently called Mind Sober Matter, which is more sobriety and mental health, but not so much on the football side.
Yeah, brilliant. Oh, good work. Awesome. Thank you so much, James. Really lovely to catch up with you, and I'm so happy for you to share your story on my show. I think hopefully a lot of men as well will listen to this. Always think it's amazing when guys talk about this stuff, because the more the merrier, you know. And
yeah, I think that's the thing. Thank you for having me on the podcast. I really appreciate it, and it's nice to see your face and hear your voice without listening to your podcast. I won't listen back to this because I cannot stand my own voice. But hopefully people that are listening don't mind it too much. But yeah, thank you for having me on. And it is important for men to talk about these things because it can still be seen as a bit of a taboo subject. So the more we talk about it, the better.
I completely agree. And thank you to everybody else. Until next time, goodbye.
Thank you so much for listening to this podcast. If you're interested in being a guest, please contact me directly on Instagram by sending a message to @sassysobermum. You can also find helpful tools and resources on my website, sassysobermum.com. If you enjoyed the podcast and you want to spread the love, please like, share, and rate the podcast. I really look forward to next time. See you then.